The service itself was going to be performed by the Dean, who had carefully made one up. There was no official civil marriage service in Ankh-Morpork, other than something approximating to, "Oh, all right then, if you really must." He nodded enthusiastically at Vimes. "We've cleaned our organ especially for the occasion," he said.
"Ha, ha, ha, organ," said the bursar.
"And a mighty one it is, as organs go." Ridcully stopped and signalled to a couple of student wizards. "Just take the bursar away and make him lie down for a while, will you?" he said. "I think someone's been feeding him meat again." There was a hiss from the far end of the great hall, and then a strangled squeak. Vimes stared at the monstrous array of pipes. "Got 8 students pumping the bellows," said Ridcully to a background of wheezes. "It's got 3 keyboards and 100 extra knobs, including 12 with question mark on them."
"Sounds impossible for a man to play," said Vimes politely.
"Ah, we had a stroke of luck there." There was a moment of sound so loud that the aural nerves shut down. When they opened again, somewhere around the pain threshold, they could just make out the opening and extremely bent bars of Fondel's Wedding March being played with gusto by someone who discovered that the instrument didn't just have 3 keyboards, but a whole range of special acoustic effects, ranging from flatulence to humorous chicken squawk. The occasional ooh of appreciation could be heard amidst the sonic explosion. Somewhere under the table, Vimes screamed at Ridcully,
"Amazing! Who built it?"
"I don't know, but it's got the name B.S. Johnson on the keyboard cover." There was a descending wail, one last hurdy-gurdy effect, and then silence. 20 minutes those lads were pumping up the reservoirs," said Ridcully, dusting himself off as he stood up. "Go easy on the Vox Dei stop. There's a good chap."
"Ooh."
The Arch-Chancellor turned back to Vimes, who was wearing the standard waxen prenuptial grimace. The hall was filling up quite well now.
I'm not an expert on this stuff," he said, "but you've got the ring, have you?"
"Yes."
"Who's giving away the bride?"
"Her uncle Lofthouse. He's a bit gaga, but she insisted."
"And the best man?"
"What?"
"The best man, you know. He hands you the ring and has to marry the bride if you run away, and so on. The Dean's been reading up on it, haven't you, Dean?"
"Oh, yes," said the Dean, who'd spent all the previous day with Lady Deirdre Wagon's book of etiquette. "She's got to marry someone once she's turned up. You can't have unmarried brides flapping around the place, being a danger to society."
"I completely forgot about a best man," said Vimes. The librarian, who'd given up on the organ until it had some more puff, brightened up.
"Ooh! Well, go and find one," said Ridcully. "You've got nearly half an hour."
"It's not as easy as that, is it? They don't grow on trees."
"Ooh!
I can't think who to ask."
"Ooh!"
The librarian liked being best man. You were allowed to kiss bridesmaids, and they weren't allowed to run away. He was really disappointed when Vimes ignored him. Acting Constable Cuddy climbed laboriously up the steps inside the Tower of Art, grumbling to himself. He knew he couldn't complain. They'd drawn lots because Carrot said, "You shouldn't ask the men to do anything you wouldn't do yourself." And he'd drawn the short straw, ha-ha, which meant the tallest building. That meant, if there was any trouble, he'd miss it. He paid no attention to the thin rope dangling from the trapdoor far above. Even if he'd thought about it, so what? It was just a rope. Gaspode looked up into the shadows. There was a growl from somewhere in the darkness. It was no ordinary dog growl. Early man had heard sounds like that in deep caves. Gaspode sat down, his tail thumped uncertainly.
"Knew I'd find you sooner or later," he said. "The old nose, eh? Finest instrument known to dog."
There was another growl. Gaspode whimpered a bit.
"The thing is," he said, "the thing is, the actual thing is, see? The thing what I've been sent to do."
Late man heard sounds like that too, just before he became late.
"I can see you don't want to talk right now," said Gaspode, "but the thing is now, I know what you're thinking. Is this Gaspode obeying orders from a human?"
Gaspode looked conspiratorially over his shoulder, as if there could be anything worse than what was in front of him.
"That's the old mess about being a dog, see?" he said. "That's the thing what Big Fido can't get his mind around, see? You looked at the dogs in the guild, right? You heard him howl? Oh, yes, death to the humans. All right, but under all that, there's the fear. There's the voice saying, bad dog. And it don't come from anywhere but inside, right from inside the bones, because humans made dogs. I knows this. I wish I didn't, but there it is. That's the power knowing. I've read books, I have. Well, chewed books.
The darkness was silent.
And you're a wolf and a human at the same time, right? Tricky, that, I can see that. Bit of a dichotomy sort of thing. Makes you kind of like a dog, because that's what a dog is, really. Half a wolf and half a human. You were right about that. We've even got names. So our bodies tell us one thing, our heads tell us another. It's a dog's life, being a dog. I bet you can't run away from him. Not really. He's your master.
The darkness was more silent. Gaspode thought he heard movement.
He wants you to come back. The thing is, if he finds you, that's it. He'll speak, and you'll have to obey. But if he goes back of your own accord, then it's your decision. You'd be happier as a human. I mean, what can I offer you except rats and a choice of fleas? I mean, I don't know. I don't see it as much of a problem. You just have to stay indoors 6 or 7 nights every month.
Angua howled. The hairs that still remained on Gaspode's back stood on end. He tried to remember which was his jugular vein.
I don't want to have to come in there and get you, he said.
Truth rang on every word.
The thing is, the actual thing is,
I will, though, he added, trembling.
It's a bugger being a dog.
He thought some more and sighed.
Oh, I remember. It's the one in the throat, he said.
Vimes stepped out into the sunlight, except that there wasn't much of it. Clouds were blowing in from the hub. And
detritus?
Dink.
Captain Vimes, sir!
Who are all these people?
Watchmen, sir!
Vimes stared in puzzlement at the half-dozen assorted guards.
Who are you? Lance Constable Rolf Pyjama, sir.
And Coalface?
I never done nothing.
I never done nothing, sir,
yelled Detritus.
Coalface? In the watch?
Dink.
Corporal Carrot says there's some good buried somewhere in everyone,
said Detritus.
And what's your job, Detritus?
Dink. Engineer in charge of deep mining operations, sir.
Vimes scratched his head. That was very nearly a joke, wasn't it? He said.
This new helmet my mate Cuddy made me, sir. People can't say there goes stupid troll. They have to say, who that good-looking military troll there? Acting constable already. Great future behind him. He got destiny written all over him like writing.
Vimes digested this. Detritus beamed at him.
And where is Sergeant Colon? Here, Captain Vimes. I need a best man, Fred. Right, sir. I'll get Corporal Carrot. He's just checking the roofs. Fred, I've known you more than 20 years. Good grief, all you have to do is stand there. Fred, you're good at that.
Carrot appeared at the trot.
Sorry I'm late, Captain Vimes. We really wanted this to be a surprise.
What? What sort of surprise?
Carrot fished in his pouch. Well, Captain, on behalf of the watch, that is, most of the watch...
Hold on a minute, said Colon. Here comes his lordship.
The clop of hooves and the rattle of harness signalled the approach of Lord Vetinari's carriage. Carrot glanced around at it. Then he looked at it again and looked up. There was a glint of metal on the roof of the tower.
Sergeant, who's on the tower?
He said.
Cuddy, sir.
Oh, right, he coughed. Anyway, Captain, we all clubbed together and... He paused. Acting Constable Cuddy, right?
Yeah, he's reliable.
The patrician's carriage was halfway towards Sartor Square now. Carrot could see the thin, dark figure in the back seat. He glanced up at the great grey bulk of the tower. He started a run.
What's up? Said Colon.
Vimes started a run too. Detritus's knuckles hit the ground as he swung after the others. And then it hit Colon, a sort of frantic tingle, as though someone had blown on his naked brain.
Oh, shit,
he said under his breath. Claws scrabbled on the dirt.
He drew his sword.
What did you expect? 1 minute the lad is on top of the world, he's got a whole new interest in his life, something probably even better than going for walks, and then he turns round and what he sees is, well, basically, a wolf. You could have hinted. It's that time of the month, that sort of thing. You can't blame him for being surprised, really.
Gaspode got to his feet.
Now, are you going to come out, or have I got to come in there and be brutally savaged?
Lord Vetinari stood up as he saw the watch running towards him. That was why the first shot went through his thigh instead of his chest. Then Carrot cleared the door of the carriage and flung himself across the man, which is why the next shot went through Carrot. Angua slunk out. Gaspode relaxed slightly.
"I can't go back," said Angua. "I..."
She froze. Her ears twitched.
"What? What?"
"He's been hurt."
Angua sprang away.
"Here, wait for me," barked Gaspode. "That's the shades that way."
A third shot knocked a chip out of Detritus, who slammed into the carriage, knocking it on its side and severing the traces. The horses scrambled away. The coachman had already made a lightning comparison between current job conditions and his rates of pay, and had vanished into the crowd. Vimes slid to a halt behind the overturned carriage. Another shot spanged off the cobbles near his arm.
"Detritus?"
"Sir?"
"How are you?"
"Oozing a bit, sir."
The shot hit the carriage wheel above Vimes's head, making it spin.
"Carrot?"
"Right through my shoulder, sir."
Vimes eased himself along on his elbows.
"Good morning, your lordship," he said manically.
He leaned back and pulled out a mangled cigar.
"Got a light?"
The patrician opened his eyes.
"Ah, Captain Vimes. And what happens now?"
Vimes grinned. Funny, he thought, how I never feel really alive until someone tries to kill me. That's when you notice that the sky is blue. Actually, not very blue right now. There's big clouds up there, but I'm noticing them.
"We wait for one more shot," he said, "and then we run for proper cover."
"I appear to be losing a lot of blood," said Lord Vetinari.
"Who would have thought you had it in you?" said Vimes, with the frankness of those probably about to die. "What about you, Carrot?"
"I can move my hand. Hurts like heck, sir, but you look worse."
Vimes looked down. There was blood all over his coat.
"A bit of stone must have caught me," he said. "I didn't even feel it."
He tried to form a mental picture of the gonne. Six tubes, all in a line, each one with its lead slug and charge of number one powder, delivered into the gonne like crossbow bolts. He wondered how long it'd take to put in another six. "But we've got him where we want him. There's only one way down out of the tower." "Yep, we might be sitting out here in the open with him shooting lead pellets at us, but we've got him just where we want him." Wheezing and farting nervously, Gaspode moved at a shambling run through the shades and saw, with a heart that sank even further, a knot of dogs ahead of him. He pushed and squirmed through the tangle of legs. Angua was at bay in a ring of teeth. The barking stopped. A couple of large dogs moved aside, and Big Fido stepped delicately forward.
"So," he said, "what we have here is not a dog at all. A spy, perhaps. There's always an enemy. Everywhere. They look like dogs, but inside they're not dogs. What were you doing?"
Angua growled.
"Oh, law," thought Gaspode. "She could probably take down a few of them, but these are street dogs."
He wriggled under a couple of bodies and emerged in the circle. Big Fido turned his red-eyed gaze on him.
"And Gaspode, too," said the poodle. "I might have known."
"You leave her alone," said Gaspode.
"Oh, you'll fight us all for her, will you?" said Big Fido.
"I got the power," said Gaspode. "You know that. I'll do it. I'll use it."
"There's no time for this," snarled Angua.
"You won't do it," said Big Fido.
"I'll do it.
Every dog's paw'll be turned against you."
"I got the power, me. You back off, all of you."
"What's power?" said Butch. He was drooling.
"Big Fido knows," said Gaspode. "He studied. Now me and her are going to walk out of here, right? Nice and slow."
The dogs looked at Big Fido.
"Get them," he said.
Angua bared her teeth. The dogs hesitated.
"A wolf's got a jaw four times stronger than any dog," said Gaspode, "and that's just an ordinary wolf."
"What are you all?" snapped Big Fido. "You're the pack. No mercy. Get them."
But a pack doesn't act like that, Angua had said. A pack is an association of free individuals. A pack doesn't leap because it's told. A pack leaps because every individual all at once decides to leap. A couple of the bigger dogs crouched. Angua moved her head from side to side, waiting for the first assault. A dog scraped the ground with its paw. Gaspode took a deep breath and adjusted his jaw. Dogs leapt.
Sit,
said Gaspode, impassable human. The command bounced back and forth around the alley, and 50% of the animals obeyed. In most cases, it was the hind 50%. Dogs in mid-spring found their treacherous legs coiling under them.
Bad dog!
And this was followed by an overpowering sense of racial shame that made them cringe automatically. A bad move in mid-air. Gaspode glanced up at Angua as bewildered dogs reined around them.
I said I got the power, didn't I?
He said.
Now, run!
Dogs are not like cats, who amusingly tolerate humans only until someone comes up with a tin opener that can be operated with a paw. Men made dogs. They took wolves and gave them human things, unnecessary intelligence, names, a desire to belong, and a twitching inferiority complex. All dogs dream wolf dreams, and know they're dreaming of biting their maker. Every dog knows deep in his heart that he is a bad dog. But Big Fido's furious yapping broke the spell.
Get them!
Angua galloped over the cobbles. There was a cart at the other end of the alley, and beyond the cart a wall.
Not that way!
Whined Gaspode. Dogs were piling along behind them. Angua leapt onto the cart.
I can't get up there, said Gaspode. Not with my leg.
She jumped down, picked him up by the scruff of his neck, and leapt back. There was a shed roof behind the cart, a ledge above that, and a few tiles slid under her paws and tumbled into the alley. A house.
I feel sick. Shut up!
Angua ran along the ridge of the roof and jumped the alley on the other side, landing heavily in some ancient thatch.
Oh! Shut up!
But the dogs were following them. It wasn't as though the alleys of the shades were very wide. Another narrow alley passed below. Gaspode swung perilously from the werewolf's jaws.
They're still behind us.
Gaspode shut his eyes as Angua bunched her muscles.
Oh, no, not Treacle Mine Road.
There was a burst of acceleration followed by a moment of calmness. Gaspode shut his eyes. Angua landed. Her paws scrabbled on the wet roof for a moment, slates cascaded off into the street, and then she was bounding up to the ridge.
You can put me down right now, said Gaspode. Right now, this minute. Here they come.
The leading dogs arrived on the opposite roof, saw the gap, and tried to turn. Claws slid on the tiles. Angua turned, fighting for breath. She'd tried to avoid breathing during the first mad dash. She'd have breathed Gaspode. They heard Big Fido's irate yapping.
Cowards! That's not 20 feet across! That's nothing to a wolf!
The dogs measured the distance doubtfully. Sometimes a dog has to get right down and ask himself, what species am I?
It's easy! I'll show you! Look!
Big Fido ran back a little way, paused, turned, ran, and leapt. There was hardly a curve to the trajectory. The little poodle accelerated out into space, powered less by muscles than by whatever it was that burned in his soul. His forepaws touched the slates, clawed for a moment on the slick surface, and found no hold. In silence, he skidded backwards down the roof, over the edge, and hung. He turned his eyes upwards to the dog that was gripping him.
Gaspode, is that you?
Yes,
said Gaspode, his mouth full. There was hardly any weight to the poodle, but then there was hardly any weight to Gaspode. He darted forward and braced his legs to take the strain, but there was nothing much to brace them against. He slid down inexorably until his front legs were in the gutter, which began to creak. Gaspode had an amazingly clear view of the street 3 stories down.
Oh, hell,
said Gaspode. Jaws gripped his tail.
Let him go,
said Angua indistinctly. Gaspode tried to shake his head.
"Stop struggling," he said out of the corner of his mouth. "Brave dog faves the day. Valiant hound in wolf got rescue. No!"
The gutter creaked again. "It's going to go," he thought. "Story of my life." Big Fido struggled around.
"What are you holding me up by?"
"Your collar," said Gaspode through his teeth.
"What? To hell with that!"
The poodle tried to twist, flailing viciously at the air.
"Stop it, you daft bugger. You'll have a fall off!"
Gaspode growled. On the opposite roof, the dog pack watched in horror. The gutter creaked again. Angua's claws scored white lines on the slate. Big Fido wrenched and spun, fighting the grip of the collar, which finally snapped. The dog turned in the air, hanging for a moment before gravity took hold.
Free.
And then he fell. Gaspode shot backwards as Angua's paws slipped from under her and landed further up the roof, legs spinning. Both of them made it to the crest and hung there, panting. Then Angua bounded away, clearing the next alley before Gasboat had stopped seeing a red mist in front of his eyes. He spat out Big Fido's collar, which slid down the roof and vanished over the edge.
"Oh, thank you," he shouted. "Thank you very much. Yes, leave me here, that's right, me with only three good legs. Don't you worry about me. If I'm lucky, I'll fall off before I starve. Oh, yes, story of my life. You and me, kid, together, we could have made it."
He turned and looked at the dogs lining the roofs on the other side of the street.
"You lot go home. Bad dog," he barked.
He slithered down the other side of the roof. There was an alley there, but it was a sheer drop. He crept along the roof to the adjoining building, but there was no way down. There was a balcony a story below, though.
"Lateral thinking," he muttered. "That's the stuff. Now, a wolf, your basic wolf, he'd jump, and if he couldn't jump, he'd be stuck. Whereas me, on account of superior intelligence, can assess the old what's-name and arrive at a solution through application of mental processes."
He nudged the gargoyle squatting on the angle of the gutter.
"If you don't help me down to that balcony, I'll whittle in your ear."
"Big Fido."
"Yes?"
"Heal."
There were eventually two theories about the end of Big Fido. The one put forward by the dog Gaspode, based on observational evidence, was that his remains were picked up by foul old Ron and sold within 5 minutes to a furrier, and that Big Fido eventually saw the light of day again as a set of earmuffs and a pair of fleecy gloves. The one believed by every other dog, based on what might tentatively be called the truth of the heart, was that he survived his fall, fled the city, and eventually led a huge pack of mountain wolves who nightly struck terror into isolated farmsteads. It made digging in the middens and hanging around back doors for scraps seem, well, more bearable. They were, after all, only doing it until Big Fido came back. His collar was kept in a secret place and visited regularly by dogs until they forgot about it. Sergeant Colon pushed open the door with the end of his pike. The tower had floors a long time ago. Now it was hollow all the way up, crisscrossed by golden shafts of light from ancient window embrasures. One of them, filled with glittering motes of dust, lanced down on what not long before had been Acting Constable Cuddy. Colon gave the body a cautious prod. It didn't move. Nothing looked like that should move. A twisted axe lay beside it.
"Oh, no," he breathed.
There was a thin rope, the sort the assassins used, hanging down from the heights. It was twitching. Colon looked up at the haze and drew his sword. He could see all the way to the top, and there was no one on the rope, which meant... He didn't even look around, which saved his life. His dive for the floor and the explosion of the gun behind him happened at exactly the same time. He swore afterwards that he felt the wind of the slug as it passed over his head. Then a figure stepped through the smoke and hit him very hard before escaping through the open door into the rain.
"Acting Constable Cuddy."
Cuddy brushed himself off.
"Oh," he said, "I see. I didn't think I was going to survive that, not after the first 100 feet.
"You were correct."
The unreal world of the living was already fading, but Cuddy glared at the twisted remains of his axe. It seemed to worry him far more than the twisted remains of Cuddy.
"And will you look at that," he said. "My dad made that axe for me. A fine weapon to take into the afterlife, I don't think."
"Is that some kind of burial custom?"
"Don't you know? You are death, aren't you?"
"That doesn't mean I have to know about burial customs. Generally, I meet people before they're buried. The ones I meet after they've been buried tend to be a bit overexcited and disinclined to discuss things."
Cuddy folded his arms.
"If I'm not going to be properly buried," he said, "I ain't going. My tortured soul will walk the world in torment."
"It doesn't have to."
"It can if it wants to," snapped the ghost of Cuddy. "Detritus, you haven't got time to ooze. Get over to the tower. Take some people with you."
Vimes reached the doorway of the great hall, with the patrician over his shoulder and Carrot stumbling along behind him. The wizards were clustered around the door. Big, heavy drops of rain were beginning to fall, hissing on the hot stones. Ridcully rolled up his sleeves.
"Hell's bells! What did that to his leg?"
"That's the gun for you. Sort him out, and Corporal Carrot too."
"There's no need," said Vetinari, trying to smile and stand up. "It's just a flesh wound."
The leg collapsed under him. Vimes blinked. He'd never expected this. The patrician was the man who always had the answers, who was never surprised. Vimes had a sense that history was flapping loose.
"We can handle it, sir," said Carrot. "I've got the men on the roofs, and—"
"Shut up, stay there, that's an order."
Vimes fumbled in his pouch and hung his badge on his torn jacket.
"Hey, you! Pyjama, I need a sword."
Pyjama looked sullen.
"I only take orders from Corporal Carrot. Give me a sword right now, you horrible little man. Right, thank you. Now, let's get to the tower."
A shadow appeared in the doorway. Detritus walked in. They looked at the limp shape in his hands. He laid it carefully on a bench without saying a word and went and sat in a corner. While the others gathered around the mortal remains of Acting Constable Cuddy, the troll removed his homemade cooling helmet and sat staring at it, turning it over and over in his hands.
"He was on the floor," said Sergeant Colon, leaning against the doorframe. "He must have been pushed off the stairs right at the top. Someone else was in there too. Must have shinned down a rope and caught me a right bang on the side of the head."
"Being pushed down the tower's not worth it for a shilling," said Carrot, vaguely.
It was better than when the dragon came, thought Vimes. After it had killed someone, it was at least still a dragon. It went somewhere else, but you could say, "That's a dragon, that is." It couldn't nip over a wall and become just another person. You always knew what you were fighting. You didn't have to...
"What's that in Cuddy's head?" he said.
He realized he'd been staring at it without seeing it for some time. He tugged at it. It was a strip of black cloth.
"Assassins wear that," said Colon blankly.
"So do lots of other people," said Ridcully. "Black's black."
"You're right," said Vimes. "Taking any action on the basis of this would be premature. You know, it'd probably get me fired."
He waved the cloth in front of Lord Vetinari.
"Assassins everywhere," he said, "on guard. Seems they didn't notice anything, eh? You gave them the bloody gun because you thought they were the best to guard it. You never even thought of giving it to the guards." "Aren't we going to give chase, Corporal Carrot?" said Pyjama. "Chase who? Chase where?" said Vimes. "He hit old Fred on the head and did a runner. He could trot around a corner, chuck the god over the wall, and who'd know? We don't know who we're looking for."
"I do," said Carrot. He stood up, holding his shoulder.
"It's easy to run," he said. "We've done a lot of running, but that's not how you hunt. You hunt by sitting still in the right place. Captain, I want the sergeant to go out there and tell people we've got the killer."
"What?"
"His name is Edward D'Eth. Say we've got him in custody. Say he was caught and badly injured, but he's alive."
"But we haven't. He's an assassin." "We haven't."
"Yes, Captain, I don't like telling lies, but it might be worth it. Anyway, it's not your problem, sir."
"It isn't? Why not?"
"You're retiring in less than an hour."
"I'm still captain right now, Corporal, so you have to tell me what's going on. That's how things work."
"We haven't got time, sir. Do it, Sergeant Colon."
"Carrot, I still run the watch. I'm the one supposed to give the orders."
Carrot hung his head. "Sorry, Captain."
"Right, so long as that's understood. Sergeant Colon?"
"Sir."
"Put out the news that we've arrested Edward D'Eth, whoever he is."
"Yes, sir."
"And your next move, Mr. Carrot?"
said Vimes. Carrot looked at the assembled wizards.
"Excuse me, sir?"
"Ooh.
First, we need to get into the library."
"First," said Vimes, "someone could lend me a helmet. I don't feel I'm at work without a helmet. Thanks, Fred. Right, helmet, sword, badge. Now."
There was a sound under the city. It filtered down by all sorts of routes, but it was indistinct. A hive noise. And there was the faintest of glows. The waters of the Ankh, to use the element in its broadest sense, had washed, to bend the definition to its limit, these tunnels for centuries. Now there was an extra sound. Footsteps padded over the silt, barely perceptible, unless ears had become accustomed to the background noise. And an indistinct shape moved through the gloom, paused at a circle of darkness leading to a smaller tunnel,